current business models collapse, those skills will need to stretch again in different directions. As elasticity of skills becomes more common, one particular category of skill it always seems to encompass is moving others. Valerie Conan, for instance, is a terrestrial ecologist for an environmental consulting firm in Edmonton, Alberta. Her work requires high-level and unique technical skills, but that's only the start. She must also submit proposals to prospective clients, pitch her services, and identify both existing and potential problems that she and her firm can solve. Plus, she told me, you must be able to sell your services within the company. Or take Sharon Twiss, who lives and works one Canadian province to the west. She's a content strategist working on redesigning the website for a large organization in Vancouver. But regardless of the formal requirements of her job, almost everything I do involves persuasion, she told me. She convinces project managers that a certain fix of the software is a priority, cajoles her colleagues to abide by the site's style guide, trains content providers about how to use the software and to follow best practices, even works to get my own way about where we're going for lunch. As she explains, people who don't have the power or authority from their job title have to find other ways to exert power. Elasticity of skills has even begun reshaping job titles. Timothy Shriver Jr. is an executive at the Future Project, a nonprofit that connects secondary school students with interesting projects to adults who can coach them. His work reaches across different areas: marketing, digital media, strategy, branding, partnerships. But he says, the common thread is activating people to move. His title? Chief Movement Officer. And even those higher on the org chart find themselves stretching. For instance, I ask Gwynne Shotwell, president of the private space transportation firm Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, also known as SpaceX, how many days each week she deals with selling on top of her operational and managerial duties. Every day, she told me, is a sales day. EdMed. Larry Ferlazzo and Jan Judson are a husband and wife who live in Sacramento, California. They don't pickle cucumbers or parse code, but they too represent the future. Ferlazzo is a high school teacher, Judson a nurse practitioner, which means that they inhabit the fastest growing sector of the United States and other advanced economies. One way to understand what's going on in the world of work is to look at the jobs people hold. That's what the U.S. Occupational Employment Statistics Program, which I mentioned earlier, does. Twice a year, it provides an analysis of 22 major occupational groups and nearly 800 detailed occupations. But another way to understand the current state and future prospects of the workforce is to look at the industries where those jobs emerge. For that, we go to the monthly employment report, and it shows a rather remarkable trend. While jobs in the manufacturing sector have been declining for 40 years, as recently as the late 1990s, the United States still employed more people in that sector than in the one called professional and business services. About 10 years ago, however, professional and business services took the lead. But its ascendance proved short-lived, because rising like a rocket was another sector, education and health services, or what I call EdMed. EdMed, which includes everyone from community college instructors to proprietors of test prep companies and from genetic counselors to registered nurses, is now by far the largest job sector in the U.S. economy, as well as a fast-growing sector in the rest of the world. In the United States, EdMed has generated significantly more new jobs in the last decade than all other sectors combined. And over the next decade, forecasters project that healthcare jobs alone will grow at double the rate of any other sector. At its core, EdMed has a singular mission. As teachers, we want to move people. Ferlazzo, who teaches English and social studies in Sacramento's largest inner-city high school, told me, moving people is the majority of what we do in healthcare, added his nurse practitioner wife. Education and healthcare are realms we often associate with caring, helping, and other softer virtues. But they have more in common with the sharp-edged world of selling than we realize. To sell well is to convince someone else to part with resources, not to deprive that person, but to leave him better off in the end. That is also what, say, a good algebra teacher does. At the beginning of a term, students don't know much about the subject, but the teacher works to convince his class to part with resources, time, attention, effort, and if they do, they will be better off when the term ends than they were when it began. I never thought of myself as a salesman, but I have come to the realization that we all are, says Holly Witt Payton, a sixth grade science teacher in Louisiana. I'm selling my students that the science lesson I'm teaching them is the most interesting thing ever, which is something Payton firmly believes. The same is true in healthcare. For instance, a physical therapist helping someone recover from injury needs that person to hand over resources, again, time, attention, and effort, because doing so, painful though it can be, will leave the patient healthier than if he kept those resources to himself. Medicine involves a lot of salesmanship, says one internist who prefers not to be named. I have to talk people into doing some fairly unpleasant things. Of course, teaching and healing aren't the same as selling electrostatic carpet sweepers. The outcomes are different. A healthy and educated population is a public good, something that is valuable in its own right and from which we all benefit. A new carpet sweeper or gleaming Winnebago? Not so much. The process can be different too. The challenge, says Filazzo, is that to move people a large distance and for the long term, we have to create the conditions where they can move themselves. Drawing on the vernacular of community organizing, Filazzo makes a distinction between irritation and agitation. Irritation, he says, is challenging people to do something that we want them to do. By contrast, agitation is challenging them to do something that they want to do. What he has discovered throughout his career is that irritation doesn't work. It might be effective in the short term, but to move people fully and deeply requires something more. Not looking at the student or the patient as a pawn on a chessboard, but as a full participant in the game. This principle of moving others relies on a different set of capabilities, in particular the qualities of attunement, which I'll explore in Chapter 4, and clarity, which I'll cover in Chapter 6. It's about leading with my ears instead of my mouth, Filazzo says. It means trying to elicit from people what their goals are for themselves and having the flexibility to frame what we do in that context. For example, in his ninth grade class last year, after finishing a unit on natural disasters, Filazzo asked his students to write an essay about the natural disaster they considered the very worst. One of his students, Filazzo calls him John, refused. This wasn't the first time either. John had struggled throughout school and had written very little, but he still hoped eventually to graduate. Filazzo told John that he wanted him to graduate too, but that graduation was unlikely if he couldn't write an essay. I then told him that I knew from previous conversation that he was on the football team and liked football, Filazzo said. I asked him what his favorite football team was. He looked a little taken aback since it seemed off topic. It looked like he had been expecting a lecture. The Raiders, he replied. Okay, then what was his least favorite team? The Giants. So Filazzo asked him to write an essay showing why the Raiders were superior to the Giants. John stayed on task, said Filazzo, asked thoughtful and practical questions, and turned in a decent essay. Then John asked to write another essay, this one about basketball, to make up for previous essays he hadn't bothered to do. Filazzo said yes. John delivered another pretty good piece of written work. Later in that week, in a parent-teacher conference with all his teachers, John's mother cried when I showed her the two essays. She said he had never written one before during his previous 9 years of schooling. Filazzo says he used agitation to challenge him on the idea of graduating from high school, and I used my ears knowing that he was interested in football. Filazzo's aim wasn't to force John to write about natural disasters, but to help him develop writing skills. He convinced John to give up resources, ego, and effort, and that helped John move himself. Filazzo's wife, the med to his ed, sees something similar with her patients. The model of healthcare is, we're the experts. We go in and tell you what to do. But she has found, and both experience and evidence confirm, that this approach has its limits. We need to take a step back and bring patients on board, she told me. People usually know themselves way better than I do. So now, in order to move people to move themselves, she tells them, I need your expertise. Patients heal faster and better when they're part of the moving process. Healthcare and education both revolve around non-sales selling, the ability to influence, to persuade, and to change behavior while striking a balance between what others want and what you can provide them. And the rising prominence of this dual sector is potentially transformative. Since novelist Upton Sinclair coined the term around 1910, and sociologist C. Wright Mills made it widespread 40 years later, experts and laypeople alike have talked about white-collar workers. But now, as populations age and demand more care, and as economies grow more complex and demand increased learning, a new type of worker is emerging. We may be entering something closer to a white-coat, white-chalk economy, where EdMed is the dominant sector and where moving others is at the core of how we earn a living. Does all this mean that you, too, are in the moving business? That entrepreneurship, elasticity, and EdMed have unwittingly turned you into a salesperson? Not necessarily. But you can find out by answering the following four questions. One, do you earn your living trying to convince others to purchase goods or services? If you answered yes, you're in sales. But you probably knew that already. If you answered no, let's go to question two. Two, do you work for yourself or run your own operation even on the side? If yes, you're in sales. Probably a mix of traditional sales and non-sales selling. If you answered no, let's go to question three. Three, does your work require elastic skills, the ability to cross boundaries and functions, to work outside your specialties, and to do a variety of different things throughout the day? If yes, you're almost certainly in sales, mostly non-sales selling with perhaps a mix of traditional sales now and then. If no, let's go to our final question, question four. Four, do you work in education or healthcare? If yes, you're in sales, the brave new world of non-sales selling. If no, and if you answer no to the first three questions, you're not in sales. So where did you end up? My guess is that you found yourself where I found myself, living uneasily in a neighborhood you might have thought was for someone else. My guess, too, is that this makes you uncomfortable. We've seen movies like Glengarry Glen Ross and Tin Men, which depict sales as fueled by greed and founded on misdeed. We've been cornered by the fast-talking commission salesperson urging us to sign on the line that is dotted. Sales, even when we give it a futuristic gloss like non-sales selling, carries a seamy reputation. And if you don't believe me, listen to the next chapter where I can tell you more. Chapter 3. From caveat emptor to caveat venditor. What do people really think of sales? To find out, I turned to an effective and often underused methodology. I asked them. As part of the What Do You Do at Work survey, I posed the following question to respondents. When you think of sales or selling, what's the first word that comes to mind? The most common answer was money. And the 10 most frequent responses included words like pitch, marketing, and persuasion. But when I combed through the list and removed the nouns, most of which were value-neutral synonyms for selling, and focused instead on the adjectives and interjections, an interesting picture emerged. Adjectives and interjections can reveal people's attitudes, since they often contain an emotional component that nouns lack. And the emotions elicited by sales or selling carry an unmistakable flavor. Of the 25 most offered words, only 5 have a positive valence: necessary, challenging, fun, essential, and important. The remainder are all negative. These negative words assemble into 2 camps. A few reflect people's discomfort with selling, words like tough, difficult, hard, painful. but most reflect their distaste. Words like pushy and aggressive figure prominently, along with a batch of adjectives that suggest deception. Slimy, smarmy, sleazy, dishonest, manipulative, and fake. This adjective test, a linguistic MRI of our brains contemplating sales, captures a common view. Selling makes many of us uncomfortable and even a bit disgusted, which is why we saw words like ick, yuck, and ugh, in part because we believe that the practice of selling revolves around duplicity, dissembling, and double dealing. To probe people's impressions further, I asked a related question, one better suited to visual thinkers. When you think of sales or selling, what's the first picture that comes to mind? Respondents had to describe their picture in five or fewer words. To my surprise, the responses, in overwhelming numbers, took a distinct form. They involved a man in a suit selling a car, generally a used one. The top five responses, by a wide margin, were car salesman, suit, used car salesman, man in a suit, and our old friend, pushy. The image that formed in respondents' minds was uniformly male. The word man even made the top 25. Very few people used the gender-neutral term salesperson, and nobody answered saleswoman. Many respondents emphasized the social aspects of sales, with outgoing, extrovert, and talker all making the top 25. Others settled on more metaphorical or literary images, including shark and Willie Loman. And some people still couldn't resist offering adjectives. Slick, sleazy, and annoying all made the list. It turns out that these two questions, taken together, can help us puncture one of the most pervasive myths about selling in all its forms. The beliefs embedded in the answers to that first question, that sales is distasteful because it's deceitful, aren't so much inherently wrong as they are woefully outdated. And the way to understand that is by pulling back the layers to the answers to that second question. Lemons and other sour subjects. In 1967, George Akerlof, a first-year economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley, wrote a 13-page paper that used economic theory and a handful of equations to examine a corner of the commercial world where few economists had dared to tread: the used car market. The first two academic journals where young Akerlof submitted his paper rejected it because they, quote, did not publish papers on topics of such triviality, end quote. The third journal also turned down Akerlof's study, but on different grounds. Its reviewers didn't say his analysis was trivial. They said it was mistaken. Finally, 2 years after he'd completed the paper, the Quarterly Journal of Economics accepted it and in 1970 published The Market for Lemons, Quality Uncertainty and the Market Mechanism. Akerlof's article went on to become one of the most cited economic papers of the last 50 years. In 2001, it earned him a Nobel Prize. In the paper, Akerlof identified a weakness in traditional economic reasoning. Most analyses in economics began by assuming that the parties to any transaction were fully informed actors making rational decisions in their own self-interest. The burgeoning field of behavioral economics has since called into question the second part of that assumption, that we're all making rational decisions in our own self-interest. Akerlof took aim at the first part, that we're fully informed, and he enlisted the used car market for what he called a finger exercise to illustrate and develop his ideas. Cars for sale, he said, oversimplifying in the name of clarifying, fall into two categories, good and bad. Bad cars, what Americans call lemons, are obviously less desirable and ought to be cheaper. Trouble is, with used cars, only the seller knows whether the vehicle is a lemon or a peach. The two parties confront an asymmetry in available information. One side is fully informed, the other is at least partially in the dark. Asymmetrical information creates all sorts of headaches. If the seller knows much more about the product than the buyer understandably gets suspicious. What's the seller concealing? Am I being hoodwinked? If the car is so great, why is he getting rid of it? As a result, the buyer might be willing to pay only very little or perhaps forego purchasing the car altogether. But Akerlof theorized that the problems could ripple further. Suppose I've got a used car that I know is a peach and I decide to sell it. Buyers still treat me the same way they treat any seller, as a presumptive lemon peddler. What's this guy Pink keeping secret? Is he bamboozling us? If the car is so peachy, why is he unloading it? One consequence is that as the seller, I settle for a price lower than the auto is worth. The other is that I give up and don't even bother trying to sell my car. Dishonest dealings tend to drive honest dealings out of the marketplace, Akerlof wrote. The presence of people who wish to pawn bad wares as good wares tends to drive out the legitimate business. And it's not just autos, he said. The same reasoning applies to insurance, credit, or one's own labor. When honest sellers opt out, the only ones who remain are the shysters and the charlatans, pushy guys in suits using sleazy tactics to stick you with a heap of junk. Ick. Of course, individuals and institutions have devised ways to make Akerlof's commercial landscape less forbidding. Sellers offer warranties on their goods. Brand names provide some assurance of quality. Legislatures pass lemon laws to protect consumers. But most important, prospective purchasers are on notice. When sellers know more than buyers, buyers must beware. It's no accident that people in the Americas, Europe, and Asia today often know only two words of Latin. In a world of information asymmetry, the guiding principle is caveat emptor. Akerlof's provocative thought piece recast how economists and others reckoned with individual transactions and entire markets. So with this example as a model, let's try another intellectual finger exercise. Imagine a world not of information asymmetry, but of something closer to information parity, where buyers and sellers have roughly equal access to relevant information. What would happen then? Actually, stop imagining that world. You're living in it. Go back to used cars. In the United States today, a prospective purchaser of, say, a used Nissan Maxima can arm herself with all manner of relevant information before even approaching a seller. She can go online and find most of the places offering that particular car within a certain radius of her home, thereby giving her a wider set of choices. She can tap her social network or visit websites to discover each dealer's reputation and whether previous customers have been satisfied. For individual sellers, she can spend 15 minutes on a search engine, checking the person's bona fides. She can visit online forums to see what current Maxima owners think of the car. She can check Kelley Blue Book, Edmunds, or Autotrader.com to find out the price used Maximas are going for. And once she sees a car she likes, she can take the auto's vehicle identification number and, with a quick online search, find out whether it's been an accident or had major repairs. She's not fully protected from unethical sellers, of course. But if she encounters any dirty dealing or ends up dissatisfied, she can do more than simply gripe to a neighbor. She can tell 100 Facebook friends, all her Twitter followers, the readers of her blog, some of whom may pass her story onto their own networks, undermining the seller's ability to deceive again. Now extend the realities of the market for cars to the market for just about anything. Buyers aren't fully informed in the idealized way that many economic models assume, but neither are they the hapless victims of asymmetrical information they once were. That's why the answers to that first question aren't wrong, they're just out of date. The belief that sales is slimy, slick, and sleazy has less to do with the nature of the activity itself than with the long-reigning but fast-fading conditions in which selling has often taken place. The balance has shifted. If you're a buyer and you've got just as much information as the seller, along with the means to talk back, you're no longer the only one who needs to be on notice. In a world of information parity, the new guiding principle is caveat venditor. Seller beware. Finding your Kowalskis. Joe Girard is the world's greatest salesman. I know because he told me. Then he sent me a few pages from Guinness World Records testifying to his achievement and confirmed by a major accounting firm. In 1 year, he sold 1,425 cars at Marola Chevrolet in Detroit. These weren't fleet sales either. They were one at a time, belly-to-belly sales, several cars every day for an entire year. It's a remarkable achievement. So how did he do it? His book, How to Sell Anything to Anybody, whose cover claims 2 million copies in print, reveals a secret, which he also shares with live audiences around the world. I guarantee you that my system will work for you if you understand it and follow it, he promises. The centerpiece is Girard's rule of 250, that each of us has 250 people in our lives we know well enough to invite to a wedding or a funeral. By reaching one person and getting her to like you and buy from you, she will connect you to others in her 250-person circle. Some of those people will do the same, and so on, in ever-widening cascades of influence. Girard advises us to fill the seats on the Ferris wheel with as many prospects as we can, to let them off the Ferris wheel for a while after they buy, and then to turn them into your bird dogs by paying them $50 for every new sale they subsequently send you. A Chevrolet sold by Joe Girard is not just a car, he writes. It is a whole relationship between me and the customer and his family and friends and the people he works with. Alas, many of the techniques Girard recommends to establish that relationship invite the unsavory adjectives we heard in response to that first question. For instance, if prospects mention they've recently been on vacation somewhere, Girard will say that he's been there too. Because wherever that guy has been, I have been, even if I never heard of the place, he writes. A lot of people out there, maybe millions, have heard of me, and thousands have bought from me. They think they know a lot about me because I know a lot about them. They think I have been to Yellowstone National Park. They think I have fished for salmon near Traverse City, Michigan. They think I have an aunt who lives near Selfridge Air Force Base. Take your pick. Dishonest, smarmy, or ugh. Girard also describes in three lengthy but glorious paragraphs one of his favorite tactics for cold calling prospective customers. It begins by choosing a name from the phone book and placing a call. Here's what he writes. Now a woman answers the phone. Hello, Mrs. Kowalski. This is Joe Girard at Marola Chevrolet. I just wanted to let you know that the car you ordered is ready, I tell her. Now remember, this is a cold call, and all I know for sure from the phone book is the party's name, address, and phone number. This Mrs. Kowalski doesn't know what I'm talking about. I'm afraid you have the wrong number. We haven't ordered a new car, she tells me. Are you sure? I ask. Pretty sure. My husband would have told me, she says. Just a minute, I say. Is this the home of Clarence J. Kowalski? No, my husband's name is Stephen. Gee, Mrs. Kowalski, I'm very sorry to have disturbed you at this hour of the day. I'm sure you're very busy. But Girard doesn't let her go. He keeps her talking so he can bait the hook. Here's more of what he writes. Mrs. Kowalski, you don't happen to be in the market for a new car, do you? If she knows they are, she'll probably say yes. But the typical answer will be, I don't think so, but you'll have to ask my husband. There it is, what I'm looking for. Oh, when can I reach him? And she'll say, he's usually home by 6. Okay, I got what I wanted. Well, fine, Mrs. Kowalski. I'll call back then if you're sure I won't be interrupting supper. I wait for her to tell me they don't eat until about 6:30, and then I thank her. From there, Girard moves to the next stage. Here's what he writes. You know what I'm going to be doing at 6 o'clock. That's right. Hello, Mr. Kowalski. This is Joe Girard at Marola Chevrolet. I spoke to Mrs. Kowalski this morning, and she suggested I call back at this time. I was wondering if you are in the market for a new Chevrolet. No, he says, not just yet. So I ask, well, when do you think you might start looking at a new car? I ask the question straight out, and he is going to think about it and give me an answer. Maybe he only wants to get rid of me, But whatever the reason, what he says is probably going to be what he really means. It's easier than trying to dream up a lie. I guess I'll be needing one in about 6 months, he says. And I finish with, fine, Mr. Kowalski. I'll be getting in touch with you then. Oh, by the way, what are you driving now? He tells me, I thank him, and hang up. Gerard files Mr. Kowalski's name along with a reminder in his calendar to call him and moves to the next name on the list. After the easy ones, Gerard writes, there are many Kowalskis if you keep searching. The fact that Gerard found enough clueless Kowalskis to become the world's greatest salesman and that he remains out and about teaching sales skills might seem to validate that information asymmetry and the ignoble tactics it allows are alive and well. But there's one more thing you should know about Joe Gerard. He hasn't actually sold a car since 1977. He quit the business more than 3 decades ago to teach others how to sell. The Deloitte and Touche audit his office sent me verifying his record is dated 1991 and covers a 15-year period beginning in 1963. Gerard's techniques might have gleamed in the mid-1970s, but in the mid-2010s, they have the whiff of old boxes forgotten in the attic. After all, these days, Mrs. Kowalski is at work. Her household has caller ID to prevent telephonic intrusions. And if a salesman did circumvent her family's defenses, she would dispatch him quickly, maybe Google his name afterwards, and tell her Facebook friends about the creepy call she received that night. Gerard and his office declined several requests for a face-to-face interview, but I did get to interview him by phone. And when I reached him one afternoon to ask how the world of sales had changed since he last commanded the showroom, he insisted that it hadn't. The effect of the internet? That is junk. I don't need that crap, he told me. Now that consumers have ample access to information, how does that alter the sales process? Not at all. There's only one way, my way. Could he be as successful on today's landscape as he was in the 1970s? Give me 9 months and I'll rule the world. To be fair, much of what Gerard advocates remains sensible and enduring. He's a staunch advocate of service after the sale. Service, 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 he told me during our conversation. He offers one of the clearest aphorisms on effective selling I've ever heard. People want a fair deal from someone they like. But more broadly, his worldview and his tactics resemble one of those old movies in which a soldier stuck on a remote island continues fighting because he hasn't gotten word that the war has ended. Contrast that to Tammy Darvish. When Gerard was selling Chevys in Detroit, Darvish was in primary school. Now she's vice president of Darcars Automotive Group, one of the largest auto dealers on the American East Coast. If her home is any indication, the car business has been very good to her. The 15,000 square foot manor where I sat down with her one afternoon contains a foyer that could double as an awesome basketball court. Darvish has dark hair that falls just past her shoulders. She's petite, friendly, and semi-intense, though the intense part seems natural and the semi an effort. Nobody in the survey pictured her when they conjured an image of sales. Darvish came to the industry the old-fashioned way. Her father owned automobile dealerships in the Washington, D.C. area. After graduating from Northwood University in Midland, Michigan, with a degree in automotive marketing, she began at the bottom, a junior sales consultant facing scorching skepticism. She was a 20-year-old woman, the boss's daughter, no less, in a heavily male field. In her first month, she outsold her peers and was named Salesman of the month. Then she did it again in month two. A career was born. Nearly 30 years later, she has watched the decline of information asymmetry reshape her business. In the old days, customers drove from dealership to dealership collecting what intelligence they could. Today, most of that is done before they show up. And in many cases, they are more educated than we are, she said. When I graduated from college, the factory invoice of a car was locked in a safe. We didn't know the cost of the cars we were selling. Today, the customer is telling me. When buyers can know more than sellers, sellers are no longer protectors and purveyors of information. They're curators and clarifiers of it, helping to make sense of the blizzard of facts, data, and option. If a customer has any question at all, Darvish told me, I can say, let's go to Chevy.com and figure out the answer together. She acknowledges that when you go into a car dealer, you expect a plaid jacket and polyester pants. But just as those questionable fashion choices have become outmoded, so have the skeezy practices they conjure. Indeed, much of what we believe about sales derives not from the inherent nature of selling, but from the information asymmetry that long defined the context in which people sold. Once that information diminishes and the seesaw rebalances, everything gets upended. For example, Dark Cars has an unusual policy of rarely hiring experienced salespeople who might have learned bad habits or acquired old school perspectives. Likewise, Darvish believes that many sales training programs are a little mechanical, that they risk turning people into selling robots who recite memorized scripts on cue and try to steamroll customers into decisions. We bring them in and we put them in a one-week training course that's not just about sales. We talk about customer service and social media. Most of all, what makes someone effective on this shifted terrain is different from the smooth-talking, back-slapping, pocket-picking stereotype of the past. Darvish says the qualities she looks for most are persistence, along with a word that no one offered when I asked them the questions about their views on selling. Empathy. You can't train someone to care, she told me. To her, the ideal salespeople are those who ask themselves, what decision would I make if that were my own mom sitting there trying to get service or buy a car? It sounds noble, and maybe it is, but today, it's how you sell cars. Joe Girard is a reason we had to live by caveat emptor. Tammy Darvish survives and thrives because she lives by caveat venditor. The decline of information asymmetry hasn't ended all forms of lying, cheating, and other sleazebaggery. One glimpse of the latest financial shenanigans from Wall Street, the city, or Hong Kong confirms that unhappy fact. When the product is complicated, credit default swaps anyone, and the potential for lucre enormous, some people will strive to maintain information imbalances and others will opt for outright deception. That won't change. As long as flawed and fallible human beings walk the planet, caveat emptor remains useful guidance. I heed this principle, so should you. But the fact that some people will take the low road doesn't mean that lots of people will. When the seller no longer holds an information advantage and the buyer has the means and the opportunity to talk back, the low road is a perilous path. Caveat venditor extends well beyond car sales to refashion most encounters that involve moving others. Take travel. In the old days, that is, 15 years ago, travel agents maintained an information monopoly that allowed the unscrupulous ones to overcharge and mistreat their customers. Not anymore. Today, a mom with a laptop has about the same access to airfares, hotel rates, and reviews as a professional. Or consider selling yourself for a job. You can no longer control all the information about yourself, some of which you selectively include in your sales document, the resume. Today, the company might still look at that resume, but, as CNN notes, the company will also browse your LinkedIn and Facebook profiles, read the gory details in your blog, and hit Google to find out more about you, good or bad, all in one sitting. The new rules of caveat venditor also govern the booming EdMed sector. Today, it's possible for a motivated secondary school student with internet access to know more about the causes of the Peloponnesian War or how to make a digital film than his teacher. Physicians, once viewed as imperial dispensers of specialized knowledge, now might see patients who've researched their ailment and arrived with a clutch of studies and a course of action. Today's educators and healthcare professionals can no longer depend on the quasi-reverence that information asymmetry often afforded them. When the balance tilts in the opposite direction, what they do and how they do it must change. EdMed, beware. A Tale of Two Saturdays. Steve Kemp is a man in a suit who sells used cars. His business, SK Motors, where everybody rides. in Lanham, Maryland, sits on a colorless patch of Maryland State Route 564, down the road from a roller rink and Grace Baptist Church. Kemp is an old-fashioned businessman, a cheerful fellow, ruddy and heavy-set, who belongs to the local Rotary Club and whose service shop offers free detailing to the teacher of the month at a neighborhood school. And SK Motors is an old-fashioned place. Its inventory of about 50 used cars, from a Mercedes-Benz SL to a Hyundai Elantra, sits in an asphalt lot ringed with starter flags. At the edge is a compact one-story, five-room structure that serves as the office. One sunny Saturday morning, two salesmen, Frank and Wayne, sip coffee in the front room, waiting for the first customer on what is always the busiest day of the week. Frank is a soft-spoken, African-American man who's 74 years old but looks 55. He's been selling cars since 1985. Wayne is about the same age, white and cantankerous, with a baseball cap and plaid shirt. Onto the lot drives a chain-smoking man in a parka and his rail-thin 20-something son, who sports a valiant attempt at a beard and a jacket that bears the name of the local electric utility. The younger man needs a car. He admires a 3-year-old Nissan Altima, but can't afford its $16,500 price. So he goes for the 1993 Ford Escort with 117,000 miles. With Frank in the front seat, he takes the car for a test drive, then they return to the front room to make a deal. He fills out a credit application. Steve's right-hand man, Jimmy, takes the application and heads to his office, which houses one of the company's two computers, to do a credit check. Whammo! The report reads like a rap sheet. The young customer has had collection actions aplenty. He's also had cars repossessed, including one he purchased from SK Motors. Frank summons Steve. They confer briefly, and Steve enters the room. "We're now at the would you if stage," he whispers to me. "Huh? Would you if we did this? Would you if we did that?" he whispers again. Steve is willing to offer a loan at SK's standard interest rate of 24% and with a tracking device attached to the car if the young man makes a $1,500 down payment. Would you if those were the terms? The man doesn't have any money for a down payment. He leaves. Two more customers come in. Neither serious. In the midst of lunch, a tall man wearing a cowboy hat and jacket emblazoned with Jack Daniels logos arrives. He's looking for a cheap car. Everyone who comes in is, and finds a burnt orange Acura for $3,700. He and Frank do a test drive. When they return, he's ready to buy. Frank doesn't say much. He just doesn't get in the way. They bargain the price down to $3,200, and the man in the cowboy hat drives off. It's 1 p.m., and SK Motors has its first sale of the day. By 2 p.m., Wayne is asleep at his desk. At about 4 p.m., Steve sells a 2003 Dodge Stratus with 70,000 miles to a woman who needs a car for her teenage son. By the time we close up shop that evening, SK Motors has sold two cars. On another Saturday, I head to another used car lot, a CarMax Auto Superstore in Rockville, Maryland. It's about 30 miles away from SK Motors in distance and light years in form. This place has more cars in the customer parking lot than SK had for sale. Its collection of vehicles spans a block-sized stretch of asphalt that looks like an airport parking lot, complete with sections designated by letters to help people find their way. Inside the main office, the place is buzzing like a low-wattage stock market floor. Two dozen desks, more than 40 salespeople, customers galore. But the biggest difference isn't size or noise. It's information. At SK Motors that Saturday, not a single customer seemed to have done even the most rudimentary research on prices, competing deals, or car quality in advance of the visit. Here, about half the customers are clutching printouts they brought from home. Others are pecking at their smartphones and iPads, and those who still need access can use a bank of computers CarMax has made available. SK Motors, which serves customers whose options are limited and whose credit is so compromised they'll tolerate monitoring devices and sky-high interest rates, can still benefit from information asymmetry. CarMax has built its business model around the opposite. The company launched in 1993, hoping to reinvent the way Americans bought used cars. 2 decades later, CarMax is a Fortune 500 company that sells more than 400,000 vehicles each year and collects annual revenue of more than $9 billion. From the start, it tried to undo the conventions that gave rise to the answers we got in that first question. For instance, it established a set price for each car, no haggling necessary. That reduces a customer's fear of being outbargained by a more informed seller. Also, CarMax salespeople, most of them decked in blue polo shirts with a company logo rather than a suit and tie, earn their pay entirely through commissions. But those commissions aren't based on the price of the car. Selling a budget car earns the same commission as selling an expensive one. That mitigates the fear that a pushy salesman will press you to buy a vehicle that's good for his wallet rather than yours. Finally, CarMax practically disgorges information. Since any customer on her own can find a report on the vehicle's condition or history, CarMax gives that to customers for free. It offers warranties, certifications, and guarantees to address the quality concerns that Akerlof identified back in 1967. But the sharpest example is in plain view when you walk into the store. Each salesperson sits at a small desk, him on one side, the customer on the other. Each desk also has a computer. In most settings, the seller would look at the computer screen and the buyer at the computer's backside. But here, the computer is positioned not in front of either party, but off to the side with its screen facing outward, so both buyer and seller can see it at the same time. It's the literal picture of information symmetry. No haggling, transparent commissions, informed customers. Once again, it sounds so enlightened. And maybe it is. But that's not why this new approach exists. This is why. On the Saturday I spent at SK Motors, a total of 8 customers came in the entire day. On the Saturday at CarMax, more than that showed up in the first 15 minutes. As we've seen, caveat venditor has become just as important as caveat emptor. Whether you're in traditional sales or non-sales selling, the low road is now harder to pass, and the high road, honesty, directness, and transparency, has become the better, more pragmatic, long-term route. Yet the idea that we're all in sales still rests uneasily for some people, in part because of a few other myths that I'll quickly address here. The first is the myth of the blockhead. "We do not seem to have gone much in for genius," wrote Fuller Brush Company founder Alfred Fuller of his sales force. The way this myth has it, the smarties go off to become engineers and lawyers, while those consigned to the less favorable portions of the IQ bell curve distribution migrate towards sales, which requires far less cognitive horsepower. Not quite. As you'll see in parts 2 and 3 of this audiobook, when simple transactional tasks can be automated, and when information parity displaces information asymmetry, moving people depends on more sophisticated skills and requires as much intellect and creativity as designing a house, reading a CT scan, or, say, writing a book. The second erroneous belief, and a reason that some people disdain sales, is the myth of the money grubber, that being effective requires being greedy and that the best and perhaps only way to succeed is to become a coin-operated selling machine. Once again, not quite. For starters, non-sales selling, especially in domains such as EdMed, has nothing to do with cash, and considerable research has shown that money is not the driving force even for the majority of people in traditional sales. What's more, as you'll hear in the sample case at the end of Chapter 9, a number of companies have actually increased sales by eliminating commissions and de-emphasizing money. Finally, many people, myself included before I began my research, believe the myth of the natural. Some people have sales chops, others don't. Some people are innately skilled at moving others, the rest of us are out of luck. Here, we confront a paradox. There are no natural salespeople, in part because We're all naturally salespeople. Each of us, because we're human, has a selling instinct, which means that anyone can master the basics of moving others. The rest of this audiobook will show you how. Part 2. How to Be. Chapter 4. Attunement. In the 1992 movie Glengarry Glen Ross, based on David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning play of the same name, four small-time salesmen inhabit the seedy Chicago office of a real estate company called Mitch and Murray. They've been struggling lately, these salesmen, so on a gloomy, rain-soaked night, the downtown bosses dispatch Blake, a cold-blooded predator in a well-tailored suit, to kick them into higher gear. In one of the epic scenes in the cinema of sales, Blake, played by a young Alec Baldwin, schools the middle-aged men on how to sell. His instruction begins with derision as he questions their masculinity and pelts them with profanities. From there, he moves to fear. "We're adding a little something to this month's sales contest," he says. "As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize?" He holds up a package. "Second prize is a set of steak knives." He pauses. "Third prize is you're fired. You get the picture?" Blake then concludes his harangue with some old-fashioned sales training, flipping over a green chalkboard and pointing to where he's written the first three letters of the alphabet. ABC, he explains. A always, BB, C closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. Always be closing is a cornerstone of the sales cathedral. Successful salespeople, like successful hunters of any species, never relent in pursuing their prey. Every utterance and each maneuver must serve a single goal, pushing the transaction to a conclusion, your conclusion, and getting the person across the table, as Blake says, to sign on the line which is dotted. Always be closing. Its simplicity makes it understandable. Its alphabeticality makes it memorable. And it can be constructive advice, keeping sellers focused on the deal's end even during its beginning and middle. But the effectiveness of this advice is waning because the conditions on which it depends are fading. When only some of us are in sales, and when buyers face minimal choices and information asymmetry, always be closing is sensible counsel. But when all of us are in sales and none of us has much of an information edge, Blake's prescription seems as dated as the electric typewriters and Rolodex cards that dot Mitch and Murray's office. Remapped conditions require revamped navigation. So here in part two, I introduce the new ABCs of moving others. A, attunement. B, buoyancy. C, clarity. Attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. These three qualities, which emerge from a rich trove of social science research, are the new requirements for effectively moving people on the remade landscape of the 21st century. We begin in this chapter with A, attunement. And to help you understand this quality, let me get you thinking about another letter. Power, empathy, and chameleons. Take a moment right now, and if there's someone in the room or your car with you, politely request 30 seconds of his or her time. Then ask that person to do the following. First, with your dominant hand, snap your fingers 5 times as quickly as you can. Then, again as quickly as you can, use the forefinger of your dominant hand to draw a capital E on your forehead. Seriously, go ahead and do this. I'll wait. If you're alone, slip this exercise into your back pocket and pull it out at your next opportunity. Now look at the way your counterpart drew his or her E. Did he or she draw it so you could read it, or so he or she could read it? Does it look readable to you, or does it look backwards to you? Since the mid-1980s, social psychologists have used this technique, call it the E test, to measure what they dub perspective taking. When confronted with an unusual or complex situation involving other people, how do we make sense of what's going on? Do we examine it only from our own point of view, or do we have the capability to step outside our own experience and imagine the emotions, perceptions, and motivations of another. Perspective taking is at the heart of our first essential quality in moving others today. Attunement is the ability to bring one's actions and outlook into harmony with other people and with the context you're in. Think of it as operating the dial on a radio. It's the capacity to move up and down the band as circumstances demand, locking in on what's being transmitted, even if those signals aren't immediately clear or obvious. The research shows that effective perspective taking, attuning yourself with others, hinges on three principles. Principle one, increase your power by reducing it. In a fascinating study a few years ago, a team of social scientists led by Adam Galinsky at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management probed the relationship between perspective taking and power. They divided their participants into two groups, the only difference being what each experienced before the key experiment. One group completed a series of exercises that induced feelings of power. The other did a different set of activities designed to emphasize their lack of power. Then researchers gave the people in each group the E-test. The results were unmistakable. High-power participants were almost three times as likely as low-power participants to draw a self-oriented E. In other words, those who'd received even a small injection of power became less likely and perhaps less able to attune themselves to someone else's point of view. Now try another test on yourself, one that doesn't require anybody's forehead. Imagine that you and your colleague Maria go out to a fancy restaurant that's been recommended by Maria's friend Ken. The experience is awful. The food stinks, the service is worse. The following day, Maria sends Ken an email that says only, "About that restaurant, it was marvelous, just marvelous." How do you think Ken will interpret that comment? Will he consider the email sincere or sarcastic? Think about it for a moment. In a related experiment, Galinsky and his crew used a version of this scenario to examine power and perspective taking from another angle and found results similar to what they uncovered with the E-test. Participants with high power generally believed that Ken found the email sarcastic. Those with low power predicted he found it sincere. Who's correct? Chances are it's the low power group. Remember, Ken has no idea what happened at the dinner. Unless Maria is a chronically sarcastic person, of which there was no evidence in the experiment, Ken had no reason to suspect insincerity on the part of his friend. To conclude that he inferred sarcasm in Maria's email depends on privileged background knowledge that Ken doesn't have. As the researchers conclude, power leads individuals to anchor too heavily on their own vantage point, insufficiently adjusting to others' perspective. The results of these studies, part of a larger body of research, point to a single conclusion, an inverse relationship between power and perspective taking. Power can move you off the proper position on the dial and scramble the signals you receive, distorting clear messages and obscuring more subtle ones. This is a hugely important insight for understanding how to move others. The ability to take another's perspective mattered less when sellers, whether a commission salesperson in an electronics store or a physician in her diploma-studded office, held all the cards. Their edge in information, again, whether that information was the reliability of a clock radio or the experiences of patients with Lyme disease, gave them the ability to command through authority and sometimes even to coerce and manipulate. But as that information advantage has withered, so has the power it once conferred. As a result, the ability to move people now depends on power's inverse. Understanding another's perspective, getting inside his head, and seeing the world through his eyes. And doing that well requires beginning from a position that would get you expelled from the Mitch and Murray always be closing school of sales. Assume you're not the one with the power. Research by Dr. Keltner at the University of California, Berkeley and others has shown that those with lower status are keener perspective takers. When you have fewer resources, Keltner explained in an interview, you're going to be more attuned to the context around.